You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Nate Page. He's in California right now. Nate, thanks for being with me.
Glad to be here.
Are you in California right now? I didn't know exactly where you are, actually, at the moment.
I am, actually. I'm in Boyle Heights, Los Angeles.
So let's talk about what you're working on right now, or what's happening in your studio, however you want to frame it, but what project are you doing now, and maybe what's the context of your work? Are you also teaching and doing other kinds of things while working on your art?
Yeah, I also teach. I teach drawing for designers, and I also work with architecture quite a bit, like interior space. So I have a large space here that I've done a lot of experiments, some more art experiments and some actual living experiments in the space, but it's always a continual project that I feel like is a part of my studio practice, even though it happens at a larger scale than my studio.
So how large is the space? Explain that a little bit. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, it's about 2,500 square feet, and it's an industrial space close to downtown Los Angeles. And I've been living and working here for 8 years now. And
wow.
Yeah, and I like this idea of partially domestic, but then partially, my art thinking production space too. And I think that kind of ties into a lot of the real world projects that I do as an artist.
So let's talk about that, because yeah, some of the projects are often large scale. I mean, if that's what you mean, as well as relating to architecture. So, so tell us what you're working on now.
So one of the projects right now is actually a second iteration of California Living Project, which was it was a Getty Initiative for Pacific Standard Time and LA Architecture that happened in 2013. And I was asked by Machine Project to do something for them. And what I did was there's this developer.
Well, let me just ask you, when you say Machine Project, tell me a little bit about, yeah, the relationship of who asked you to do it, yeah, and as you were about to say, how that relates to the developer or the situation.
Yeah, so Machine Project is an experimental art space in Los Angeles here that's been going on for at least 15 years. And I started working with them just out of grad school. I went to CalArts. And he does a lot of programming as his art practice and mashing up different classes and performances. And we started working together, and I would design and do interventions in spaces, and then they would inhabit the spaces and deal with them. And then when there's no programming going on, my installation would kind of operate like an environment and also a standalone sculpture that would like activate the space while there wasn't performances happening. So I'd worked with them for a while, and they were asked by Pacific Standard Time to do something, and Mark Allen of Machine Projects asked me to do a project for that. Kind of a long daisy chain of associations there.
Okay, and what is the project that you're, I guess, in the process of proposing or doing for them?
No, I did it, and now I'm doing a second iteration in Silicon Valley. And it's with Joseph Eichler Homes, which are some pretty popular mid-century modern housing tracts that were developed in the 50s. And one of the key things about them is the back is completely glass, almost completely glass walls that open up to nature or the backyard. And the fronts actually have about like 2% windows. So they kind of look like the back of a strip mall, just like these large, expansive, opaque concrete surfaces at the front of the street, from the street view. So my project was I filmed the inhabitants and at nighttime, and they had the choice to be there or not, to perform or not or do whatever they wanted to. And I filmed homeowners, and then for one night I projected on 9 of the homes out of there's 90 homes in the subdivision. And 1-to-1 scale using the fronts of the houses as a projection screen. So it essentially used video to turn the houses inside out, and people would walk around and discover them, and it also implicated the other homes as possible projection screens.
So were you filming the back of the house then, or were you inside the house filming?
I was filming from the backyard. Like, it's, there's this voyeuristic sort of point of view of the camera. So it was the same frame, because the houses are modular and symmetrical, so when you flip the back of the house onto the front, it's the same shapes, so they fit right in to each other.
Right, that's cool. I get that. I can visualize that. So then that was done at one time in those homes, but you're saying you're repeating that same process on more of the same architects' homes?
Yeah.
These were kind of modular homes, you were saying, that were reproduced?
Yeah. They become really popular as sort of like a mid-century modern gem now. So they're pretty expensive, but it's in Palo Alto, that area of Silicon Valley, they have the largest concentration of his developments in the country. So there's, you know, thousands and thousands of those homes there. And the reason why, like, I wanted to do a second iteration was I started collaborating with a dancer friend of mine, Chelsea Zafiro, and I was thinking about one of the aspects that was important to me in the project that maybe didn't come through so much in the first iteration, which was sort of this, or became more interesting to me after the first iteration, was this idea of being viewed or like performing or not performing, sort of like for the camera, and like wondering if these homeowners were actually like were they putting on a performance? Were they like how aware? To what degree were they performing a certain lifestyle?
They knew they were being filmed, and they knew the film would be used. Yeah, and to what degree does that change what they're doing or make their movements more self-conscious?
Exactly. Yeah. So that was something that we started discussing, and for the second iteration now, we are incorporating some subtle dance or subtle movement scores into the mix of the homeowners. So Chelsea and I are choreographing based off of the first film's videos that we did in Granada Hills, which was where we did the first one. And we want to kind of create this a little bit more tension between in the viewer if there's somebody is performing or not. So it's not going to be very obvious if somebody is a dancer or a homeowner and they're going to inhabit the house. And those will be intermixed in the new homeowner videos that we're working with in Palo Alto.
Okay. So let me just understand that a little bit. So you're just as you did before, you're filming the back of the house, but in this case, there's a dancer inside that house with the family that's there. But as a viewer, we don't know whether that dancer is part of the family or not. He or she isn't making obvious dance kind of moves. Is that what you're saying?
They could be, yeah, they're not going to be obvious dance moves. And they could be intermixed with that particular family. They could be, the family could be totally absent and it's just dancers and you wouldn't know, or it could just be all family members in the different videos. So we could be shooting up to like 30 different houses, you know, so not every house is going to be a mix of dancer and homeowner. There could be all dancer, all homeowner, or a mix, or nobody at all.
So you'll keep experimenting with that and make essentially 30 different films, or collect films from 30 houses? I mean, how many images or films will it be in the end for projection?
Yeah, like at this point, it really becomes a collaboration with the community there and how much interest there is from the people there and who wants to participate, who doesn't, and to what degree they want to participate. And that's the process that we're in right now is working with like the actual collaborative process with the homeowners now. So like it also takes inspiration somewhat from the architectural design as being modular, that these were tract homes to begin with, and they're designed to be very affordable for, you know, working class Americans to help with the housing boom at that time. And
right.
So some of the videos also get switched and projected onto different homes. So the projection that you're seeing might not be those homeowners, you know. And likewise, it's like this archive that's compiling through the first iteration to the second. So homes from Los Angeles can also be projected onto homes in Silicon Valley. And it's this like video archive that now I think what was interesting to me is like how, like in the neighborhood, maybe more the Keeping Up with the Joneses idea, and that the people in Silicon Valley are now going to be looking at past, some clips of past videos and maybe deciding to do something based off of that if they choose to. And so I'm also kind of interested in this psychology developing through time just within collaborating with the homeowners.
That's interesting because, right, they'll slowly evolve as they start watching what you've done, what the homeowners and actors or dancers have done. I mean, those will all start influencing one another as the... And so how will it be shown when, on certain days, let's say this project is done or comes to fruition, when will that be exhibited and for how long?
Yeah, we're doing it right in the neighborhood itself, and our...
Is it in Palo Alto?
Yeah, this one is going to be in Palo Alto, and the goal is for spring of next year. That it'll be most likely going to be a one night event, but that's also another aspect of collaborating with the community. Like if they start to have ideas or are comfortable with doing it for two nights, we could do that. But it wouldn't really be longer than one or two nights at the most, you know.
That's exciting. That sounds like a kind of large-scale project just to collect that footage and to open up the door for so much collaboration and experimentation.
Yeah, and really, like, my initial interest was this idea of openness and isolation that I associate with modern architecture, but then also my personal experience growing up in the suburbs, you know, like not really knowing your neighbors and walking around at night and kind of seeing the TV on in somebody's window and kind of trying to figure out who these people are by what they might have been watching, you know, these little glimpses that you get. But it was like that glowing experience of like hopefulness, but like also like just feeling alienated and disconnected from people was something that I saw as very symbolic in these Eichler homes because of their front facades that have like absolutely no windows and the backs that are completely, all the walls are windows to the back.
That is a very interesting kind of design. I mean, I think of, you know, I mean, that's very interesting what you just said. Also, it reminded me that, you know, these are essentially from the back anyway, glass houses that people are living in. Right. That's also a sort of, I mean, we all have this voyeuristic thing. Yeah, looking in windows, you know, of houses that are glowing, TVs, what's going on. It's like you want to look in, but glass houses, it's as though they're intended for you to look in and to be watching like the inhabitants are animals in a cage, which is a very strange idea in architecture around that time, right? Starting with I.M. Pei's house, but that kind of thing has been used in many houses. This sort of solid wall or large glass portion where what are we doing? Watching the inhabitants? The inhabitants want to be watched, you know?
Right. It's kind of like some like inverted like perversion of a zoo because it was really like done under the guise of or the intention of opening up to nature, you know, rather than like a viewing voyeuristic reasoning, you know? So bringing in nature into the architecture was like a really big thing with modern architecture, especially in California at that time, you know. And there's a lot of architects that I've worked with their designs and their thinking about that. Like another one is is Rudolf Schindler and the Schindler House here in Los Angeles.
Right.
was really influential to me about that. But then I think there came like this idea that, you know, you have to have a balance between like this openness and some kind of privacy in order to be comfortable, to actually feel like you're sheltered, like not just from the elements, but also from a community. If you're, you know, a tract home community, it's not like you're one house in out in nature with nothing around it, you know, where a glass house might be a little bit more, you know, comforting in some ways, but.
Well, if you were surrounded by woods, it would be more comforting if it wasn't maybe necessarily next to houses in tract house rows or something. But either way, I would think for people to get used to being in a glass house. I was in one once. A friend has one that's largely glass, and to me it was an uncomfortable feeling. You know, my wife did like that the outside seemed to come in, but I tend to feel naked in those houses. You want to draw the shade. That home to me is about a kind of privacy as opposed to what seems like exhibitionism if you have that much glass.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and I think that's sort of one of the things that potentially I could be tapping into is giving like this space for people to have that like repressed exhibitionism or voyeurism, you know, in the community as like somehow like creating these parameters for that to be acceptable, and it becomes its own thing based off of the logic of the designs that they're living in.
That makes sense. And as you're saying, that seems to lead almost to, it seems almost like a natural conclusion what you're doing, or a natural path, as if, and maybe this is a stretch, so stop me if you think this is off, but that the glass house is kind of exhibiting, you're kind of exhibiting yourself in some way for you to come in. It's sort of like they're getting ready for their close-up all the time while they're living in this kind of observed environment. Now you're coming in with a camera, and that would almost seem like a natural extension, right? Time to make the movie.
I think it could be, and I think people treat it differently. You know, there's this one woman who had a really interesting comment in when we met with her up in Palo Alto, and she grew up with a front porch, and these homes don't have that front porch at all, you know, so all the activity of the family, of the homeowners, is inside the house and in the backyard, you know. So she was always used to having, like, this exterior life displayed to the neighborhood through the front porch, you know. And she almost saw this as a project where she could exercise and maybe catch the neighbors up on, if they would have had a front porch this whole time, this is what her kids had been doing for the last 9 years. You know, so almost like writing the script of the history of the things that happened in the backyard to perform now for the camera. And I thought that was really interesting because, I mean, I guess it just goes to like some ideas that the design environments like absolutely kind of affect our psychology, you know, and how we would choose to take action or behave, you know. And she has a very particular one that's based on a front porch that is also
how we behave, you mean also in the context of neighbors in a small community that we're interacting with somehow through our homes,
mm-hmm.
or short distance travels. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm also really curious about those things where the edges of how much you want to still display to your neighbors, even though it's within the framework of a participatory performance art project, you know, you get some leeway, but at the same time, like, are they going to keep restraint and held back? And I think that's where you just have the individuals can respond really differently.
Right. I'm really glad we talked about this particular project because I can see it'll go on for a while. I want to ask you a little bit about just how you're also entering into the marketplace, so to speak. This work is as you're saying, it's performative, it's not object-oriented, it doesn't seem like it could be acquired easily, or, you know, you're in this kind of nonprofit sector. Is that how you want it to remain, and will you continue doing, you think, art in like, public projects through this type of commission or proposal process, or is there another way you're moving in the art world. I'm just saying, is that a conscious thing? Is that, will that be the trajectory of what you're doing next, the kind of more of these nonprofit collaborations?
I think it's most likely, because of my makeup, it's always going to be a major part of what I do as an artist. My parents were both civil servants, so I always attach value to something that helps the larger whole of humanity somehow, you know. And I think when I was younger, I would get frustrated working just in the studio because of the limited, the limits of whatever the medium I was, but then also just like the limits of who has access to art, you know, was kind of limited in itself too. So I think that that's always been a struggle for me, is like going back and forth between studio and doing these spatial projects in public or semi-public. Because I also, this is funny, because I also started off as, my focus was observational drawing as an undergrad, and that's like where I come from. It was in Wisconsin, so there wasn't much access to a lot of the more interesting contemporary art, like in the 90s, that was going on. So I didn't know about that stuff, and I was doing observational drawing, like trying to create this sense of space from looking at something onto a two-dimensional surface, you know. And I, for myself, I made a leap, like taking my ideas of drawing into real space, and that's kind of the trajectory that I've been on. And I think recently I've been starting to look back into drawing as maybe like partially the, like what you're talking about, the marketplace, and as potentially,
well,
something.
Not that you have to be in the marketplace, but it is a choice, right? Whether to make objects or to function in these other, you know, myriad ways of experimenting and working outside those institutions.
I think you're right, but I also feel like I don't always have so much of a choice. Like I need to go with what I feel like is important, you know, and what is effective. And a lot of times when I would make a more like smaller art objects, like I didn't feel they were important enough or effective enough, you know, as my work outside of the studio or the gallery, you know, working in real space.
Right.
Yeah. So in that way, like, you know, sometimes like I wish I could be like this awesome painter, because some things would be so much easier, you know. I would have my things that I worked with all the time. I wouldn't have to ask for all this permission and get an okay in order to go into a neighborhood and start working with their neighborhood. You know, I would just have to buy my paints and go there, and my parameters that I set and the materials are all right there for me to jump in and work on.
Nate, before we go, I wanted to ask you if there's a book you're reading now, or a blog or anything, or what are you reading at the moment, if you wouldn't mind sharing that with us?
Sure. I thought of two things. One that I kind of put down for the other, but I just finished East of Eden by Jack
Great.
Steinbeck. Yeah. And so that's still kind of like resonating in my brain. And before that, I was reading a nonfiction book that was Anti-Intellectualism in American Culture.
Nate, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.